For the week of August 26th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 421, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Hey, Sperling.
How are you? How is Birmingham?
Well, I'm in mourning.
Why is that? Is it John McCain? Senator John McCain has passed
away.
That's
true. But, you know, in terms of entertainment, The Big Bang Theory is coming to an end. After 12 seasons, The Big Bang Theory is calling it a day. Apparently, Jim Parsons is calling it a day. And frankly, it's not a decade too soon.
I'll be honest with you. I didn't know that they were still in first run episodes.
They're like one of the top rated sitcoms on television, shows, period.
I know, but just like there are a lot of series that I just stopped watching after the second or third season. Orange is the New Black. I love that series. And yet somehow I've just stopped watching it. And I probably should get back to it.
No, you don't have to, but you should be aware that it's still on.
I know.
All right. Well, you know, you got to stay on top of the news. And a great way to do it is Showbiz Sandbox.
That's right. This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we can declare that the Paramount decrees they're not dead yet. Just as the Justice Department decided to review the rulings on vertical ownership and see if they are outdated, a small theater in Texas is suing AMC over geographical clearances. It could be the first case to go to a jury trial on this issue since the rulings were made 70 years ago. Oh my goodness, this is like fodder for me. I love this stuff. In any case, in China news, yet another film has bombed at the box office so completely that it was yanked from theaters when the weekend was over. Meanwhile, MoviePass has changed its rules again. This time, they're taking on annual subscribers. Wait a second, that's me, annual subscribers. I'm an annual subscriber. In sexual misconduct news, Asia Argento, explains what happened with that sexual harassment charge. And she makes matters worse for herself. On Inside Baseball, we look at the movement in the UK theatrical world to treat actors with a little more respect and wonder if it might cross the pond and influence casting in the United States. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, which we just argued about, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times, you, our listeners. And the number one movie around the world is Ant-Man and the Wasp. Thank you, China. Just opened up in China. Terrific opening weekend. $73 million, $545 million worldwide. That means Ant-Man and the Wasp has made more than the first Ant-Man.
But now, you might be wondering, like, why all of a sudden is it opening in China? Didn't it open in around the rest of the world, like, I don't know, you know, weeks ago? And the answer is yes. But in China, there is a blackout period during August because they want to release Chinese films during that month.
Well, it's not unusual that movies would open up scattered around the world at different points. Ant-Man and the Wasp, do they have Japan left, or does Mission Impossible has China and Japan left? I think it's Mission Impossible Fallout that has China and Japan left. So, I mean, it just happens depending on scheduling and all that sort of thing, and football and school and holidays. So the funny thing is that nowadays it's less and less common, right? I mean, that used to be very typical. Movies would take 6 months or a year to roll out. Nowadays, you know, they do happen a lot more concurrently around the world.
Yeah, well, it's a lot easier logistically.
Yeah, right. And is it easier with digital prints?
Oh, that's what I mean. That is exactly what I mean.
Now, we know that North America is digital. It's all digital. There are theaters equipped for 35mm prints, but essentially every movie shown from a new release from a studio is digital. Where does that stand worldwide?
Worldwide, it's pretty much everywhere, to the point where I actually attended the EMEA The Real Thing conference this past week at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And this is a group that is the Association of, oh gosh, I should know this. Basically, it's the Film Preservationists. And there are like 35 labs or something like that around the world that still do 35mm film development and printing.
35 compared to what?
And I know I just got that number wrong, but it's like some ridiculous number. It's a low, very low number, where there were used to be labs in every state. There used to be labs in every country. Now there's like a handful of labs.
Hmm. And so your point in mentioning all that was that there's so few labs left in the world, that just shows how few prints there are circulating?
Correct, yes. So to answer your question more directly, I don't know the exact number, but I would not doubt if it's 95% digital.
Mm. So there's just some very small, out-of-the-way markets that maybe haven't been able to afford the transition. I mean, what about India, I wonder?
India is probably, if not on digital cinema, then on what is called e-cinema, which is kind of like high def.
What's the difference?
Digital cinema is DCI compliant. It's above 2K or 2K or above. It's not, you know, 1920 by 1080. It complies to certain standards and specifications, whereas, you know, e-cinema, it can be HD. It doesn't have to comply to all of the DCI standards, which are very difficult to adhere to and very expensive.
And the point is that China and India and Indonesia, they're countries with huge middle classes and tons of major sophisticated markets, but they also are reaching out into smaller rural areas that aren't as developed yet, and therefore those parts of the country might be more likely to not have the full digital cinema like we're talking about.
That's right. As a matter of fact, in India, it was kind of a, I don't want to say a big deal, but a very quiet deal that Fast and Furious, I think it was 6, Universal released it in India on e-cinema. Now, of course, they said, we will never release something that isn't DCI compliant. Everything has to be a DCP and encoded and, you know, piracy protected and, you know, everything has to be locked down. And they, because they knew that they couldn't get that territory in India, if they didn't release it in a, you know, less, you know, in an e-cinema way, they released it that way. They didn't make a lot of hay about it, but that's the way they released that film.
So that's interesting. The other point I want to make about Ant-Man and the Wasp, our number one film in the world, that's now the higher grossing of the two Ant-Man films and still going strong, is the budget. We always talk about the budget and we always recognize, hey, we don't really know the budget. This is sort of just what people are assuming is the budget or what they want us to think is the budget, which may be lower than it is or higher than it is. The budget for Ant-Man and the Wasp, we've been saying, is about $130 million. Deadline Hollywood says $160 million. Bloomberg says they think it's $200 million. Whatever the result is, whether it's 130 or 200, this movie's going to pass the $600 million mark. And that means it'll be a solid box office hit right off the bat, just from theatrical alone. But we always recognize we don't really know the numbers on these movies. We're just giving our best guess.
No, but think about it this way. Even, okay, let's say it breaks even theatrically, you know, and we already know this and it's going to make money. Think of, it's a Disney film. They will have all of the theme park rides, you know, a theme park ride where everything is big and you're the ant. You know, it's going to make money in its ancillary markets.
Right, but we can't take that as a given, and it's more likely to do that when it has been a success theatrically.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's when we talk about box office hits and bombs. We recognize if you don't make money theatrically, it doesn't mean the movie has lost money. It just means you're not an out-of-the-gate hit.
Right, and you asked about which film hadn't opened in China yet. It is Mission Impossible, which has not opened.
No, I was to Japan, too. I wasn't sure if Ant-Man had opened up in Japan. I knew Mission Impossible Fallout hadn't opened in China or Japan because that's coming next weekend. So Ant-Man and the Wasp will face competition. Will it hold up? We shall have to see. Holding up worldwide is The Meg, the giant shark movie. $45 million on the weekend, $408 million worldwide. We've been saying $130 million is the budget. Box office profit every week has been saying, yeah. They claim it's 130, but this sucker's at least 150. An odd distinction for just $20 million, but they've been very assertive about it. I feel like maybe they have seen the numbers on this one. But, you know, box office profit is a cool site. If you haven't checked it out, you should. At number three is our big story of the week. Ant-Man and the Wasp had a great opening in China, but Crazy Rich Asians had a tremendous hold in North America. It's now in 19 markets. It made $31 million on the weekend. It's at $83 million worldwide. They've already approved the sequel because they didn't know if it was a guaranteed hit. It has proven a big hit. Word of mouth has been tremendous. And in North America, it held at less than a 6% drop. Basically, it made $25 million last week, and it made $25 million this weekend. And that just means great, great legs for this romantic comedy.
Right. And this is what we were arguing about before we started recording, which is, I guess we cited Box Office Mojo as saying it was one of the smallest drops of all time. And we discovered it was the 26th smallest drop of all time. That's what we were.
Which is tremendous. Yeah. And that means the first 19 movies on that list had held or even grown in their second weekend. Right. And then the 20th film had actually dropped by like less than 1%. I mean, a less than 6% drop is crazy. That's really a terrific number. So that shows everybody who went to that movie last weekend loved it, told their friends, you went to see it this weekend. We saw the number of Asians as a percentage of the weekend box office drop. The first weekend, it was almost 40%. The second weekend, it was almost 30%, which is great news because it means more and more people are coming, more Blacks, more Latinx, more white. So it is diversifying its audience, reaching a broader audience, getting great word of mouth. This is going to be a big, big hit for weeks to come.
Right. And keep in mind, this is not... it wasn't a holiday weekend. A lot of these films that grew in their second week were released over Christmas or released over, July 4th holiday.
Well, that doesn't make it easier to have a hold on the second weekend the movie has to deliver. It just means it is a time of year that's really competitive and when a lot of people are going to the movies. But yeah, you're number 26 on an all-time list. That's probably good news, and it certainly is. At number 4 around the world is the Tom Cruise flick Mission Impossible Fallout. $21 million on the weekend, $538 million worldwide, and it still has China and Japan to go, so they look like they're in great shape in order to hit $700 million, just like the last two Mission Impossible flicks. And number 5 is the Adam Sandler animated flick Hotel Transylvania 3. There will be a Hotel Transylvania 4, I'm sure of it, because this one is at $460 million worldwide. And number 6 is Mamma Mia. Here we go again. $13 million on the weekend, $305 million worldwide. Now here's the first new movie of the week. At number 7 is our first new movie on the list. It's Big Brother, a Hong Kong action flick starring Donnie Yen. It's about a soldier turned school teacher who must use his martial arts skills when a student gets kidnapped. $15 million, I guess it opened up on a Wednesday, so it's at $15 million total right now. And number 8 is Denzel Washington's The Equalizer 2. That passes the $145 million mark. And at number 9, on a film I kind of wanted to see, Alpha. I don't know why.
Why would you want to see Alpha?
It's a prehistoric boy and his dog story. Who wouldn't want to see that? Got kind of interesting reviews. I like the Hughes brothers. It made $12 million on the weekend. It's at $27 million worldwide. MoviePass, of course, we'll get to their rule change in a little bit, but they have now started to tell you, okay, you can see this movie, these movies on Tuesday, these movies on Wednesday. They chart out your whole week for you. So I said, okay, I can go see Alpha on Wednesday.
Oh, I was confusing this with Axel. Okay.
No, Axel. Nobody wants to see Axel. So Alpha, so it's on Wednesday. I said, okay, I'll be able to see Alpha on Wednesday. I got to plan ahead. Thank you, MoviePass. So I go Wednesday. No. Not so much. I had to go see it at a matinee. If I wanted to go see it at 8 p.m., they're like, no. So you could go on a Wednesday, but only during the day is what I found out when Wednesday rolled around, which wasn't convenient for us. So I'm like, okay, this is ridiculous. I'm really going to cancel MoviePass now. This is ridiculous. It's like I can go at 2 p.m. on a Thursday to see this movie and 9 p.m. on a Saturday to see that movie. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, that's the thing with MoviePass is I'm always very leery about making sure that the film that I want to see is on the site or that the showtime I want is still available, because very often if it's past noon, you may not be able to see it,
Right. Once or twice I went to the theater at like first thing in the morning as soon as they opened, and I was able to buy my ticket at that point. And then later in the day, I could see they had blocked it out and nobody could go to the movie. So even that has been ended because it was first thing in the morning and I wasn't allowed to go to anything except a daytime show.
I actually used it to go to the Landmark here in Los Angeles, which has a deal with MoviePass. And, I was able to see Eighth Grade, but I had to go to the Landmark to do it.
But I thought, was that on an approved list of this week's movies for you?
It doesn't matter because it's at one of their, deal.
I didn't know that all their theaters at Cinepolis and Landmark were eligible. That's the only reason I haven't canceled yet. I was going to look into that when I got back to New York.
Yes, if it's a theater that they have a deal with, all titles are available, all showtimes.
Well, all right. Not on the list right now is Disney's Christopher Robin. That made $12 million on the weekend. It's at $112 million worldwide. Right below that, number 11 is Mark Wahlberg's action flick Mile 22. That's at $31 million worldwide. At number 12, another new movie on the list, Melissa McCarthy had a bad weekend. The Happy Time Murders, a film where puppets and people share a reality, and there's a murder, and she's trying to solve it, and the puppets are hilarious. They're vulgar. They have sex. They do drugs. You'll never stop laughing, except apparently people did.
All males under the age of 50 wanted to see this movie. It was the number one movie for them.
What happened? I noticed this last weekend. Suddenly you're demo crazy. Where are you getting all these numbers? Suddenly all you do is men who are 45 and own a video game went to see the Happy Time Murders.
From Movie Weekend Insights. I have you.
Well, the insight is that nobody went. It's the lowest opening weekend for a movie starring Melissa McCarthy. It got dreadful reviews. Nobody went. It made $11 million. It was a flop, and the drop-off day to day was horrible. So nobody wanted to see this movie. So if you say, hey, guys, it's like, no. Everybody hated it. And the people who saw it hated it. And it's going to be off the charts, you know, in a weekend or two. That's the story. And number 13 is Spike Lee's Black Klansman. Another $11 million. Great hold for this weekend. $40 million and counting. That makes it, other than The Inside Job, which is a real outlier for Spike Lee, it's almost a work for hire with Jodie Foster. You know, he deserves credit for it. It was a big hit. It made $185 million worldwide. Outside of that movie, The Black Klansman is his second highest grossing film of all time, not adjusting for inflation. Malcolm X hit $48 million, so it's very likely Black Klansman will beat that movie. However, I think it has to make about $90 million in order to beat it in terms of when you adjust for inflation. Nonetheless, a big hit for Spike Lee. And number 14 is The Incredibles 2, another $10 million for that movie. Slender Man made a little bit more money. That has now tripled its budget of $10 million because it's at $33 million worldwide. The Chinese dramedy The Island, that made about $190 million worldwide. And scrolling down for some new news, here's a new movie, On Your Wedding Day. This is at number 19. It's a Korean romantic comedy about a man invited to the wedding of the girl he believes he's fated to be with. They were friends in high school, and he always loved her secretly, and he never said anything. But now she's invited him to her wedding, and I guess complications will ensue.
Not just complications, hijinks.
Hijinks will ensue. And if it's good, I can imagine Hollywood remaking it.
Yes, likewise.
It just sounds like a slam dunk Hollywood remake.
My best friend's wedding.
They think, well, that's not what that plot is.
I know.
That's just a movie with a wedding in it.
Right.
Which is half the movies ever made. I have a friend in Singapore who's from Singapore, who I asked, you know, what did you think about the movie? You know, I know, are you even going to go see it? And he's like, no, he has no interest in seeing it. It doesn't represent Singapore. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't feature other minorities. They ignore all the different groups of people in Singapore, blah, blah, blah. But he doesn't object to the movie. And he thinks it's an important film. He's glad people are going. He knows basically all his Asian American friends love it. And all his Singaporean friends have no interest in it whatsoever.
Yes, I have to say, the people I know from Singapore, and Patrick Vonsikovsky, my partner in crime over there at Celluloid Junkie, he lived there for like 4 or 5 years. And he's like, yeah.
My dad lived there for a decade. Yeah.
Yeah, no. He's like, this is not representative.
But he's not. Well, nobody. Yes. But he said they don't feature other minorities and it's not representative of real life in Singapore. And I said, just like every other romantic comedy ever made,
right,
they don't
include
a lot of minorities and they're not representative of real life. That's true. However, I will say, his sophisticated response to the movie is not the same as regular Singaporeans because it just opened up in that country to $1.8 million. It was a great opening weekend. I believe the best of all time for a romantic comedy.
Wow. So romantic comedies are back. Not that they ever went away. It's just that Hollywood studios stopped making them.
Exactly. They may stop making movies in China, right? I mean, this is goofy, isn't it?
Well, I don't even know what you're referring to now.
Well, a couple weekends ago, they released a movie. It did so poorly, they yanked it from the theaters and said, we're going to try again later.
Oh, okay.
They've done it again with Kung Fu, an animated film spun off from a hit TV series about an adventurous steamed dumpling. It opened this weekend. It did terrible, $420,000 on opening weekend. They yanked it from the movie theaters. The director apologized. He vowed to edit the movie and try again and re-release it later. So I feel like someone needs to send them a memo saying, you know what? You don't get do-overs.
Yeah. Well, what is it with like food as the main character of movies these days? You got Slender Man with its pasta. I'm sure the sequel will be like ravioli or something like that. And then an adventurous dumpling.
Didn't you know the guy who did the Meatballs movie?
Yeah, that's true. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so maybe he started that new trend.
Okay.
Well, there is a trend, of course, in suits, lawsuits. People love suing each other. And this one involves the Paramount decree, so I know you're going to be excited to talk about
it. Oh, yes. This is my favorite subject, is the Paramount decree. He said somewhat sarcastically, but somewhat actually truthfully. Okay, this has been going on for a while, and one of the things we all know is that the Paramount decrees prevent block booking. You can't say, if you don't play all of my smaller films, I won't give you Star Wars or the big film. You can't do that. And you can't, as a studio, own a movie theater chain. You can't do that either. One of the things that exhibitors try and do is block out territories or block out geographical areas and say, okay, if I play your film, Star Wars, in this 5-mile range, you can't book at any other theaters. And there has been some, and that's called clearance.
But if they do a too broad of a clearance, that has been illegal ever since the Paramount decrees, right?
Yes.
However, correct. It's never been enforced.
Yes, it's never been enforced. And for instance, when Star Wars opened up, the original Star Wars, it opened up at the Chinese theater, Grauman's Chinese theater, and all of the ones successively opened at the Chinese theater, the lines around the block, all those pictures from the 1977 and 1980, those are all at the Chinese theater in Hollywood, right?
Right.
And then when the prequels, when they opened, they were booked at the Cinerama Dome. And they could not be booked at the Chinese theater. And there was a big hoo-ha over it. You know, how could they not be booked at the Chinese theater? That's where the originals opened. And that was because of clearance. And that's where, you know, one exhibitor says, if you play it across the street, I'm not going to play it.
Right.
And so they have to, you know, the...
So clearances are allowed. They just cannot be overbroad.
Correct.
And what happened here is that there is Viva Cinemas in Texas. It's a one theater chain, perhaps. So I don't know if it's even more than one theater. Maybe it's a couple. But they basically specialize in dubbed and subtitled prints for the Hispanic Latinx market. And those are markets that are not served at all by big chains like AMC. But they wanted certain movies like Iron Man and Fast and Furious. And AMC demanded geographical clearances and wouldn't let the studio, or had an agreement that made sure the studio didn't release prints to Viva. And Viva's very unhappy. They went out of business and now they are suing. And they're saying they are suing AMC and saying that was unfair competition. You shouldn't be able to do it under the Paramount decree. And from my perspective, it was pretty stupid of AMC. I guess there are audiences that would go see a movie that's not subtitled or dubbed, even if they would prefer to do that. But in general, I feel like, wow, they were really serving an audience that you weren't. So why not just let them do that one thing and that one, you know, it just seems like a very small specialized audience that they were, you know, bigfooting.
Right. Well, and that's kind of, you know, a big chain's way sometimes. And what I will say is that, you know, one of the problems with this lawsuit is that it's very difficult to prove clearance, and that clearance is overbroad. The question of whether clearance is even legal and could be enforced or you know, could result in an antitrust case has always been, you know, a question. Now that it is coming down to this particular case, and by the way, there was another case here in Palm Springs in the Inland Empire, where a Steve Mason and his theater chain was saying, look, we can't book titles because AMC and Regal, and they're booking all the titles, and we're being told by the studios that they can't play us because they're playing across the street. Well, who's making that rule? Is it the studios or is it the other theater chains? It's hard to to prove.
Right, right. As the Hollywood Reporter put it, under antitrust law, that means that to prove a violation of the Sherman Act, Viva must show AMC and studios engaged in a conspiracy. The conspiracy had the effect of restraining trade, and that trade was restrained in the relevant market. So it's a pretty high bar.
Right. Well, not only that, you have, and part of proving it is actually having the physical proof of that. And very often, these are deals cut on a phone. You know, it's like a conversation. So you can't even find.
Well, but if you can look at 50 years and never, ever, ever does anybody else get the movie when they have it, you can go, well, that's pretty clear. Surely at some point you can look at a pattern of 30 years and go, well, there we go. That's a pretty clear pattern. It's not, how could it be happenstance that would always be the case unless they had an agreement?
Yeah, I don't know if that's good enough for court.
It's good enough for me.
Yeah, it's good. Well, what I would say is that heaven forbid during discovery an email crops up where, you know, some film buyer said to a studio or vice versa, you know, okay, we won't play across the street because you're
well, across the street would be okay. That wouldn't be too broad, right?
It's No, it's down, it's like the next town over or, right. You know, yeah. It's like with like,
and in this case, you're looking at a market, a very specialized market, which is why I think, you know, suddenly you want to have a movie dubbed in, you know, in Chinese and they're saying no, like, cause they don't want to show a movie in dubbed, you know, subtitled or dubbed. So why they are blocking that, you know, do they envision that growing into a bigger and bigger market? In which case, maybe you should devote one screen to subtitled and dubbed film, you know? You know, Hollywood movies dubbed. If you finally, you've got a lot of people in your market who are Spanish language speaking or Chinese speaking, maybe you should, you know? And instead, nobody got to see them.
Yeah, it's...
Well, there you go. And nobody got to see movies thanks to MoviePass last week. You know, all these last months, every time MoviePass changed their terms and says, oh, only 3 movies a month... There was always a couple people in my life who were like, ha ha, I'm an annual subscriber. I'm an annual subscriber. I get the special rules going on and on and on.
And who might these people be? Might they
be? Not just you.
Yeah, I was one of those people.
And now the chickens have come home to roost.
Yeah, so, you know, and I even got an email like a couple weeks ago when they lowered the number of movies you could see per month to 3. Mm-hmm. They said, okay, you're an annual subscriber, so that rule doesn't apply to you. Now, keep in mind that when your subscription lapses in January of 2019, you're going to have to go to a monthly or, you know, you will be a part of that rule unless you cancel at that time. And I thought, well, okay, I have until January to figure that out. And by the way, I have until January to figure out if you're even still going to be in business and whether I have to make a decision at all anyway. And that said, I guess this week they decided to, no, they're going to change it. No, annual subscribers can no longer see unlimited movies. It's 3 movies per month.
So they can, you can quit and they will pay you back the prorated amount left on your annual subscription. But you have to decide fast. You only have till August 31st. So my question is, will you quit or will you hold on to it?
Here's the deal.
And if you quit, you can't rejoin for 9 months. Forget that 6-month rule we had before. Now you can't join for 9 months, and as if they'll be around 9 months.
I was just going to say, yeah, well, that might not be a problem either. As far as, you know, whether I will quit or not by August 31st, the way I look at it is I've seen like 12 movies already using MoviePass. So I've already prepaid for 12 movies. I paid $90 for my, you know, in other words, I saw all these movies at a reduced price. So why would I quit? Number one. Number two, I have another 6 months left on my my subscription. So I'll probably see 2 or 3 movies a month, maybe 1 or 2. So what does it matter? Number three, I'm a Costco. I bought my annual membership at Costco. And so far I have not received an email informing me that,
this is the case
that, yeah. And I think it's because they can't control anything. They couldn't control search pricing through the Costco members. They couldn't control raising the price through the Costco members.
So you might still have a loophole.
Yeah, it might be the one loophole. And I am sure they're trying to figure out how to close that loophole.
Well, that'll be interesting. You'll have to let us know if they ever inform you that you're on the barrel, or maybe you'll still have it through January.
Right. And then, of course, as soon as it lapses, they're going to say, okay, now you're ours and you have to pay us directly. And as soon as you do that, then any rule they create will apply.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we know we're all over MoviePass. Never has a tiny company with a bad business model ever been detailed and analyzed so carefully as MoviePass. But one area that we don't know a lot about is video games. It's hard to get data on video games because the industry doesn't share like grosses weekly and stuff like that. Every once in a while, they'll say this game is worth $1 billion, you know, but it's really hard to track video games. They keep their data close at hand. It's a really big market. We're not fans and players of video games. We don't go online and take part in all that stuff. So every once in a while, a story hits us and we go, wow, I didn't realize that was happening. And that's certainly the case with Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah. Okay. So Grand Theft Auto, I guess what we're talking about music here, right?
Well, at video games and the crossover to music. I mean, Grand Theft Auto is a franchise, of course.
$6 billion.
$6 billion and counting. They've gone to online, just like a lot of other people. They've sold like 100 million copies of Grand Theft Auto, but now they have GTA Online, which they keep adding new things and new rooms and new stuff to do, which adds to the complexity of the game, adds to the appeal, and keeps people feeding in their quarters, which is the way I always think about it because I'm really old.
Right, you know, and one of the things they do, and these are like all add-ons, there's a name for it, which is totally escaping me now, and it's got an acronym, which is, you know, these supplemental content packs, you know, where you can...
You can buy new costumes or new skills or new whatever, or access a new level of the game. So everybody's got these games online. That's where the video game world is moving. You're not going to have consoles in your home and buy a cartridge. Those days are dying. And one thing that they have added a lot to in Grand Theft Auto is music. Now, the company behind it has always been really big into music. They've always used music very prominently. They had a noir game, an L.A. noir game, and they had like old Ella Fitzgerald songs. And I mean, they went hard, and Billie Holiday. They licensed really good music for their games. And Grand Theft Auto apparently has had a big amount of music on it. They feature 18 online radio stations because, you know, you're in your car driving around, driving over prostitutes and whatever ridiculous stuff they have you do, because the game is controversial. You know, you break things, you break the law, you steal, you commit horrible crimes, but you're in your car, and apparently you can choose different radio stations. So you pick different radio stations based on your music, and they're actually programmed with original music. Not original, but like they license really good songs from other people. So they also have clubs, and one of the big things they added was a new club scene where you can buy your own club in the Grand Theft Auto world. You can run it as a legit club, or you can run it as a front for organized crime. And you can even book DJs and hire them. And they've got four of the biggest DJs around who they went to the elaborate process of bringing them to the studio, setting up a whole nightclub, and then filming them doing a set.
Well, here's the question. If you're running your club as a front for organized crime, can you rough up the DJ? Rough up the talent?
I'm pretty sure these DJs had that in their... No, you can't beat the crap out of us. And in fact, the Black Madonna, who's a really big DJ internationally, they got the Black Madonna to come and do this. And she actually wanted it in her... She said, I want to punch out a fake cop. She said, like someone who's posing as a cop, who's not a cop. She's not assaulting a real police officer, but she wanted to punch out a fake cop. And so she did. And others of them had little storylines that they filmed, like jumping out of planes or doing this and that and other stuff. But mostly they're DJing down to the point where they did, motion capture of them and the audience members, and they captured everything, how they do their set, how they move, the drinks that they're having, whether it's water or, you know, a certain type or, you know, some liquor, they got everything. And so now when you go into a nightclub, you can watch the Black Madonna do an actual original set in the, Grand Theft Auto world. And it's a really big business. They brought in all these people. They've done it. It's a really big part of the game. They're introducing people to lots of original live music. It's a really big factor. They paid a lot of money to bring these people in and get the atmosphere right. And these DJs are finding weird real world influences by them being in the Grand Theft Auto game. They're all really popular. But she saw Black Madonna said she saw like
a spike
flyers
in sales.
Of kids saying the Black Madonna is going to be my, and she's like, what? I'm not. And then she realized it was kids getting together to play Grand Theft Auto. And they had the rights to her to be their DJ in their club. So she said, come over to my house. We'll hang out and play Grand Theft Auto and watch a set by the Black Madonna. So she's like, oh, I really am doing that. So it's kind of this bizarre thing. So, you know, it's a big factor in the music. I had never thought about this, never knew about it. And I'm sure it's influencing sales and stuff like that. I'm sure we'll get more information about that down the road.
Right. And it's like downloadable content, you know, DLC is what I was referring to.
There must be a Grand Theft Auto playlist, I am sure, on Spotify. I'm just assuming that. I haven't even looked it up, but I'm sure you'll find that if you look. That stuff played on Grand Theft Auto starts to trend and gets on the playlist on Spotify and spikes in sales. So I think that's cool. You're watching music. You're hearing, you're seeing great DJs. You can maybe never afford to see them in real life, but you can go online to Grand Theft Auto and watch their set. That's kind of cool. What shouldn't, you know, online gaming is really cool. It's a really big business, but it shouldn't be dangerous because you're online. And yet, horribly, over the weekend, another mass shooting in the U.S. This was the second shooting in Jacksonville, Florida, within about a week. At this one, three people are dead, and it took place at an esports event, a John Madden NFL game event. It was a competition for players trying to compete to get to the national finals. And it was in Jacksonville, Florida. And unfortunately, one of the people shot up and killed two other people, shot and wounded a number of other people, and then killed himself. So a horrible thing. But, you know, when you talk about esports and people are going, what was going on? What was this? It's esports really have not broken through in terms of visibility. People don't quite realize how big this is. But when you read a story about this shooting, you find out, oh, teammates were flown in from other parts of the country. This isn't some local kid in Jacksonville. These are players who make their living on this. They flew in from other parts of the country. You had quotes from the heads of certain teams who were competing. You find out that some of these tournaments, like, what was it you're talking about? Dota 2?
Dota 2, the tournament that I think either just took place or is taking place right now, the prize is $25
million. $5 million. That's more than, I think, any sporting event.
Well, and think about it. The Overwatch leagues that have sprung up everywhere for the game Overwatch, those players on the LA team are paid a minimum of $50,000. Now, if they do well, they are going
to be... $50,000 a year?
Oh, yeah.
Right. Well, I'm just wondering if it was more than that. I didn't know.
Well,
if it was
that's
just
like
for
the, that's their base, and of course, if they do well and they kind of advance in their league, then they make even more money. So it's kind of
that's a heck of a lot better than most players like in tennis.
That's right. You know, that's why I'm saying
lose money on the tour. Yeah, I mean, there's base levels in baseball which are much higher than $50,000, but you know, once you get on the major leagues, boom. But yeah, that's pretty amazing. That's really competitive salary. I guess you really should not have stopped playing Asteroids when you were a kid, Sperling.
Yeah, I don't know that I ever could have made money playing Asteroids or Pac-Man. Maybe Pac-Man, but certainly not Asteroids.
At Pac-Man is where you were at.
Qbert more. Qbert Frogger maybe.
That's a sad news about the shooting. It does remind us yet again how big a sport esports is and what a big part of the entertainment business it is. And so is sexual misconduct.
Unfortunately.
Yes. Asia Argento, of course, 2 weeks ago, we found that she herself had been paid off a person who accused her of sexual assault. She spoke up finally after an initial statement and really did herself no favor. She said, "I didn't pay him. My boyfriend paid him." Which really does not really help a lot. But that was, of course, her late boyfriend, Anthony Bourdain. And as she said, he tried to extort her. And then rather than having a long, drawn-out battle in the press during the Weinstein scandal, Anthony Bourdain said, "Let's just give him some money." And so her quote is, "We decided to deal compassionately with Bennett's demand for help and gave it to him." End quote. It's like, no. You don't pay someone $380,000 because you feel bad for them. That's pretending that's an act of mercy and kindness just does not cut it. So, you know, she really did herself no favors here, saying that Bourdain paid, not her, and it was just to make him go away. It's like, no. That's the same thing you hear from other people. So,
yeah, well, but that said, and I'm not taking any sides here, I will point out that the initial request for, you know, money or intent to sue, which was how this all started, was sent to Anthony Bourdain's attorney. Not hers, not her representatives. It was sent to Anthony Bourdain's people. And
I don't know what that changes anything other than you're saying about who paid it. I mean, but they obviously worked together to decide. But the one thing that was interesting was that the actor, I think his name is Jimmy Bennett.
Jimmy Bennett, yeah.
Yeah, he came forward and said, you know, I was... Initially, when I approached them and threatened to sue, I was embarrassed to come forward. I was ashamed, and I felt like as a man that somehow that was somehow more shameful, and I was too embarrassed and ashamed to be public with my accusation, and that was wrong, and I've seen these other people come forward, and I should have done that too, and that's why I'm stepping forward now. Because, and you know, that actually explanation holds weight. Yet, you know, men are more embarrassed to talk about being sexually assaulted or raped. So hearing him say that, and explaining why he wasn't public before and why he didn't publicly talk about what she did, It rang true, whereas her comments do not. So not a good week for Ozzy Argento. But again, you can be sexually assaulted and also sexually assault someone else. So does not change the facts that we have in her case and the many other women accusing Harvey Weinstein of sexual assault and rape. And certainly from what we know, it looks like she did a very bad thing and paid a price for it.
Well, that wraps up our sexual misconduct news and moves us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Hey, we got some good news for women here.
That's true. Could awards for the best sci-fi novel be a political predictor? If so, President Trump and the Republican Party are in for a rude November. The Hugo and Nebula Awards are two biggies when it comes to sci-fi and fantasy. The Nebula Awards are voted on by writers, specifically those who are members of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. The Hugos are voted on by fans, especially those committed enough to attend the annual convention. For the last few years, the Hugos have been embroiled by controversy as a small but vocal group of mostly white, mostly male voters have complained the Hugos have been taken over by political correctness. They were tired of seeing Hugos go to women and people of color and to novels and stories about social issues rather than sweeping tales of epic space battles. You know, real sci-fi. Suddenly, instead of arguments about Star Trek versus Star Wars and Asimov versus Vonnegut, you were hearing about pitched battles over gender and race. While the narrow-minded folk lost after striving to stuff the ballots with old white men and old plot lines, the real fans, who love all types of writing, fought back in the best way possible, by registering to vote, and then showing up, and then voting. That's why one of the best sci-fi writers of today just won her third Hugo Award in a row for best novel. The Stone Sky is the title, and the fact that Jemisin is a woman of color is merely the icing on the cake. And guess what? Her fellow writers agree with the fans. The Stone Sky also won this year's Nebula Award. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. N.K. Jemisin is a terrific writer. It's very rare to win three in a row, which she has done. It's a hugely acclaimed trilogy. I'm looking forward to checking it out. I haven't done that yet. The list of books I want to read always grows longer, but it's very cool to see. And clearly, this is just where the best writing is happening right now. You know, it might happen once in protest. It ain't happening 3 years in a row, and you're not having the fellow peers of her writers agree with this, you know, decision, with this award, because it ain't happening unless she's got the goods, and she does.
Speaking of having the goods, a few weeks ago, we joked about musical acts doing Vegas and how that no longer means your career has come to an end creatively. Well, maybe the new version of going to Vegas can be found on Broadway. That's where Oscar winner Cuba Gooding Jr. will be headed for 6 weeks starting in October when he joins the long-running musical Chicago. Gooding popped up into the London version, which just returned to the West End after a much-needed rest, and now he's coming to show New York critics that he can't really sing, and certainly he can't dance, not much at all. His role, sleazy lawyer Billy Flynn, and several others have been played by so many B-list celebrities over the years that whoever handles casting deserves at the least an award for endurance. We're talking Jerry Springer, Usher, Maxwell Caulfield, Alan Thicke, the list goes on and on and on. And now you can add Cuba Gooding Jr. to that list. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's, you know, guy gets job, right? Hello, Karen. It is funny. It is just, this show has rotated in and out so many people. And the idea that you actually should be able to sing and dance and perform in Chicago is so quaint an idea that it's really just gone by the wayside. But speaking of people changing roles, Lauren Ambrose is leaving My Fair Lady after just 6 months. A few weeks ago, we felt like Diana Rigg was shoved aside after she criticized Lauren Ambrose for not working an eight-week schedule. And
Diana Rigg, an eight-day schedule? 8 days per week.
A performance schedule, yes. And she got the big heave-ho and is being replaced by Rosemary Harris. Now suddenly Lauren Ambrose is leaving My Fair Lady after just 6 months. She's moving on to do an M. Night Shyamalan show at Apple. 6 months really seems a short amount of time to have committed to such a big production. Maybe it was always intended, but they certainly didn't make that clear in advance as they should have. Like, oh, she's only here for 6 months. So I feel like, I don't know what's going on here, but Laura Benanti is stepping into the role. She's a terrific actress. I hope I get a chance to see the show again because I'd love to see her in it. And Lauren Ambrose did a good job, but 6 months is really early to leave. So not a happy times at My Fair Lady.
And you know what you know, the Broadway producers are saying? They're saying, what? We thought only TV networks had to worry about, you know, these streaming services coming in and stealing their talent.
Yeah, really.
A new study suggests, speaking of streaming services, this study suggests about 9% of all Netflix's 130 million users worldwide are gaining access by using someone else's password. Despite different levels of piracy all over the world, the study found this percentage was fairly steady across territories. The more penetration Netflix enjoyed, however, the lower the abuse. So in the US, the biggest market for Netflix, the percentage of people stealing access was lowest. In France, where Netflix hasn't gained a lot of ground, the percentage of illegal access was higher. There is a widely held belief that password sharing among Netflix homes is rife, but our data is telling a different story, noted Guy Bisson, I think is his name, the research director of Ampere Analysis, which produced the report in association with MIT Trends. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. I love that they said, hey, it's only 9%.
Well, I'm sure Netflix knows how many people are sharing passwords, but I'm sure everybody assumed it was like 30%.
Well, but 9% is a ton. That's 11 million users worldwide. That's $110 million a month in lost revenue, or $1 billion a year. $1 billion a year, and they had the nerve to say, oh, it's not that high. That's a lot of stealing. So I think the, you know, your perception of like, well, that's not so much. It's like, no. 1 out of 10 people watching Netflix is stealing access. That's a lot.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, they are probably stealing access so they can watch the Great British Baking Show. Netflix has had the rerun rights to that show, and now they have snagged the rights to new episodes away from PBS here in North America. So I guess now Netflix has it all over the world, I imagine.
Well, think about it. This is a perfect way for the technology that runs Netflix and Amazon Prime. They know what's popular. They know what people will watch. They know when they turn it off. They know how deep into an episode they go.
They know how when they watch it again and again.
Right. And yeah. They know, like, gee, okay, on episode 6, that's when we lose most viewers, you know, on any series.
So the British Baking Show had huge turmoil in the UK. They switched from one channel to another channel. Several hosts did not make the leap with them and started their own new show, which is about to launch in the fall. But the original show, even having moved to a new channel, maintained a really strong viewership, about 10 million people a week tuning in ultimately. Factored in lot plus 7. So now that channel is in this show, and now it's going to Netflix. So we'll have to see if it appears off the radar like the auto show that they had that was such a wide hit.
Now, I know this next story. Last week, Michael pleaded with Billboard to fix its methodology in this next story.
Please, please.
By the way, Nicki Minaj did the same thing when her new album didn't come in number one. So Billboard's system of measuring the hottest singles and best-selling albums is out of whack. That cri de coeur came about because Travis Scott has all 18 tracks from his latest album appearing on the Hot 100. Well, Michael's going to get upset again, and this time it's the most cherished record of all, album sales. The Eagles have just vaulted past Michael Jackson to claim the best-selling album of all time in North America. The Eagles' album is their greatest hits 1971 to 1975, and it's just been certified for going 9 times platinum in the past 12 years. That brings its total sales to 38 times platinum, leaving Thriller way back at 33 million copies. Number 3 on the list? The Eagles again, with Hotel California, 26 million copies and counting. So that's either a lot of 8-track tapes are being sold, or that's a lot of streaming. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, worldwide, Thriller is confirmed for at least 47 million copies, even though they came 66 million copies. So this is North America we're talking about. Right. The Eagles' greatest hit set is at 42 million copies worldwide. So, you know, Michael Jackson is still on top worldwide. And when he was recording his follow-up album, Bad, the one following Thriller, he had the number 100 scrawled on his bathroom mirror. He wanted to sell 100 million copies. Why not? You know, there's 8 billion people on the planet, or 6 billion people at the time. He's like, I want to sell 100 million copies. That guy thought big. But this is the problem. They're comparing apples to oranges. They're converting streaming into album sales. It doesn't work. Don't try and compare on-demand streaming to album sales. It's a new thing. When we had the LP invented, we didn't pretend LPs and singles were the same thing. Now, in fact, when you talk about how many records Elvis Presley sold, they often say records because they don't want to distinguish between albums and singles, because most acts were selling a lot of singles back then. Fats Domino, Elvis Presley, all those acts, they will talk about 500 million records sold because they are pushing together singles and albums. But we know they're different things and they've been separated. Streaming and album sales are different things. And if somebody hasn't streamed, if me, an individual user, hasn't streamed a majority of the tracks on the album, I have not listened to that album a single time. That's what you should be tracking. Individual users listening to at least a majority of the tracks on the album. And every time they hit a majority of the tracks again, that's another album stream. That's what you should be measuring. It's a new thing. Don't pretend it's album sales. They're really screwing up 100 years of methodology. It's crazy. I'd love to see a list of the most streamed albums of all time. And it'd be cool to see if the Beatles and other people got on this too, because it's a new different list. But you cannot conflate all this. You're ruining 100 years of information, and it's a shame.
I agree with you, by the way, but let's move on to the next story because it kind of continues the trend here. Nicki Minaj is not going to be pleased with this story. This week, artist Ariana Grande scored her third number one album with the new release, Sweetener. Grande and Minaj duetted on a song that appears on both of their albums. Both of their new albums have this one song, and both of those new albums were slated to come out on Friday, August 24th. Girl power! But then Minaj said, oh, wait, we're both putting out albums on August 24th? Yeah, no, I was thinking more like August 17th. And she unexpectedly dropped her album 1 week early. When Minaj's Queen didn't hit number one, she blamed a host of reasons, some on Target and some not so much. Seeing Ariana Grande hit number one just 1 week later, which might, you know, that probably hurt Minaj a little bit more. It might make the triumph for Grande a little bit sweeter. See what I did there with the sweetener?
Ah, I got it.
Okay. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. 127,000 traditional album sales. She actually sold 127,000 copies. Who are the young people that are buying this album? Are they doing it at Target, Walmart? I don't know, but it's cool. That's like the equivalent of, I mean, 500,000 probably 5 or 10 years ago, or even 1 million. I mean, that's a lot of albums this day and age.
Yeah. I mean, what are they playing it on? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that was one of the things that really struck me going to the AMIA conference, was that, you know, a lot of the equipment that you would use for rolling stock 35 millimeter film, whether it's at the theater or in a film lab, it's gone. You can't find it. So
makes it awfully hard to use it.
Right. So my question is, what's going on with CDs? I know that, you know, we all still have CD players in cars, and at least most of us do.
Maybe boomboxes are the new thing.
Yeah, who knows? The stunt coordinator on the CBS drama MacGyver was seriously injured on set. Justin Sundquist suffered a head injury when doing a stunt that involved falling off a moving vehicle. Doctors put him into a medically induced coma, and he remains hospitalized. 1 year ago, Sundquist sued CBS and CBS Studios for an injury he sustained while working on Hawaii Five-0. Something tells me he should get another job. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, you know, I haven't seen an update on his health condition, so I don't know what the deal is. So obviously our thoughts are with him and his family, but it just reminds us, no matter how careful you are, this stuff is dangerous. You know, when people do these things, we think, oh, nobody should ever get injured or hurt when they're doing stunts. You know what? They're doing dangerous things, and things are going to go wrong. It doesn't mean it's acceptable. You don't want to change the rules and conditions to make sure it doesn't happen again next time. But boy, oh boy, it's a frightening reminder that all the stuff that people do all the time really does involve risk.
You know, one of the things they showed at the EMEA conference was a very old, report about CBS Television City. And it was Edward R. Murrow giving a tour in, I think it was 1952 or 1953, of Television City, which had just recently opened in Hollywood. And it was like a cutting edge television studio, four sound stages, and you know, all of these shows could be filmed there simultaneously, and there were rehearsal halls, and Edward R. Murrow walked through, you know, with the camera, smoking a cigarette, of course, and showed like how the lighting was done and how sets were built. And one of the things he did was he sat in on the Jack Benny show, and a rehearsal for it. And I guess Jack Benny and his writers decided, oh, we're going to do a little skit when Edward R. Murrow shows up. So they were sitting around the table, and the writers were saying, okay, you know, Jack, we need a minute and a half of extra time here. So, you know, that bit where you slide down the stair railing, we think it would be funnier if you stood on the railing and slid down. And Jack Benny says, what do you mean? That sounds dangerous. I don't want to do that. And the writers say, oh, don't worry. We'll get a stuntman to do that. It's not a problem. And then the other writer, number two, says, oh, and you know that thing where you're standing on the dresser and you fall off? We think it would be funnier if you grabbed onto the chandelier and swung across the room and then fell. And Jack Benny says, well, what are you talking about? What am I, Tarzan? The writer says, don't worry. We'll get a stuntman to do that too. And Jack Benny says, well, you know, if you're getting a stuntman to do it, that's fine. And Eddie Anderson, one of the cast members, comes up and says, hey, boss, they need you over on stage to finish rehearsal. Meanwhile, the writers say, okay, turn to page 13 because we're rewriting one of those jokes. And Jack Benny turns to page 13 and he looks at the bottom of the page. He goes, oh, actually, that joke is really funny. I really like that joke. That's really funny. And Eddie Anderson says, oh, don't worry, boss. We can get a comedian to do that one. I don't know. Maybe you have to see it. It was very funny.
Yeah, that's funny.
Okay, Disney. This next story is about Disney. We've reported in the past about tensions between Disney and the city of Anaheim. As the largest employer in the area, Disney demands all sorts of breaks from the city, including subsidies and tax breaks. But now the company says it is walking away from hundreds of millions of dollars. Why? Because if they accept the money, they will be forced to raise the minimum wage for park employees to $15 an hour, and then $18 an hour, and then it will be pegged to inflation after that. Disney also may lose out on a $267 million rebate package for building a new luxury hotel. In short, they'd rather give up tax breaks than pay a living wage to its 30,000 local employees. Disney made $9 billion in net profit last year, and its CEO Robert Iger could make more than $420 million over the next 4 years. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It seems bizarre. You can imagine that in 2020, the national minimum wage will be raised to $15 and pegged to inflation if the Democrats take control of the House and the Senate. So, you know, you're really going to give up hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks today to fight off something that's probably inevitable anyway? It seems unwise financially and, of course, just immoral and unethical. In fact, they really try to divide and conquer here. They've already agreed to pay $15 an hour to one third of their workers who are in a union. At the same time, they chose to pay $15.75 to another third who aren't union because they want to encourage those people to not join the union. I mean, they're just trying to really peg, force people to fend off against one another and keep them divided and conquered. The final third, I guess, it just has no leverage whatsoever, and so they don't have to worry about them, and they're still stuck at $9 an hour or whatever they get. So, you know, it seems petty, seems stupid, especially when you're ignoring the inevitable nationally of a $15 an hour minimum wage.
Now that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, if you're an actor, well, this might affect you, because as we all know, the life of an actor is filled with rejection.
But even No. Go away. No, you're too tall. You're too short. You're wrong for the part. You're too old.
Pretty much. But even worse, say some actors, is when you don't get rejected at all. You just get ignored. Again and again, they audition for commercials or movies or TV shows or plays, and they hear nothing. Crickets, as I like to say. Eventually, they realize no news is pretty much bad news, but it's annoying. Well, in the UK theater world, that might be changing. The hashtag yes or no campaign is gaining momentum, with top theaters and casting directors signing on. They are pledging to simply let actors know yes or no. Every actor for every audition. Curve chief executive Chris Stafford and artistic director Nikolai Foster said, a 10-minute audition can mean several hours prep with reading and research and singing lessons, etc., and travel for an artist. It's vital we acknowledge that whether they got the job or not, the National Theater, the Royal Shakespeare Company, and the Old Vic, many more as well, they've all signed on. I almost said big deal or big whoop. But
yeah, no, it's you know, I think it's very interesting. I think it's one more example of trying to treat people with dignity at every stage of the business. And when you treat people with dignity, it really does tie into sexual misconduct. When you treat people with dignity and respect, you're less likely to treat them like sexual objects and less likely to have all the problems that come with sexual harassment and assault and rape and diversity and things that happen when you do not acknowledge, you know, the decency and humanity of people. However, let's point out a couple things. The big thing is that theater is maybe the easiest lift. When you're looking at movies and TV and commercials and theater, theater, especially plays, is the easiest area to put this into practice. They probably see fewer people for parts. Musicals and, you know, with dances and stuff in the chorus line, that can get really big. If you're recasting Annie, you'll see thousands of kids. But in the theater, with a play, with maybe five roles, you're not going to see the numbers of people that you do for movies and commercials and TV shows. TV may be the hardest. You're doing a new episode every 10 days. That's pretty typical for television. For a sitcom, it might be every 7 days. And every role might have dozens of people auditioning for it. And you often will be casting 20 roles in a week on an episodic drama. That's really not unusual. Sometimes 70 people for a part. You can suddenly see when you start to add that up, you're talking thousands of people every week that you need to inform yes or no.
Yeah, so I mean, unless there's a system and put in place, I mean, I'm sure that's why, you know, the habit of just, you know, not returning the call was instituted.
Right. Right. Nowadays, with email and new technology, you think, okay, this is doable. In the old days, with a telephone call, even just as to the agent for maybe five of the people audition, you know, you don't want to call. You don't want to say, they didn't get the part. Really? What was wrong? You know, they're going to want an explanation. You don't want to talk to them. It gets really onerous. It's emotional. It's difficult. You're giving bad news. And it's a lot of phone calls. And they don't have spare people sitting around to make phone calls for, you know, 8 hours in a day just to tell 1,000 different people you didn't get the part. That's a lot of phone calls. So now, though, with email and stuff like that, you know, now maybe you want to do that. And one suggestion I heard was that there's this website called Breakdown Express. That's where a lot of people interact and where perhaps casting people would be able to send out a mass email and at least say maybe for that everybody, all the agents or all the people who auditioned for a certain episode, not even just the role, but maybe you could just send out a mass email and say, the part's been filled. Thank you. If you auditioned, we're sorry, you know, the part's been filled. And that would just go out to everybody that was involved. So I think email could make this problem, and it really is a problem, the idea that, you know, you audition and you just never hear anything. That's not cool. So, and in the old days, you couldn't solve that problem, but today you can. I think theater in London is doing this, and I think it's probably going to spread here, and you might as well be proactive and say, can we do this with the new stuff, maybe with working with Breakdown Express or some other things? Can we do this so that it doesn't create an extra 10 hours of work a day for an employee? And get the word out to people and let them know.
Well,
so
I think yes, you could use Breakdown is a service that started ages ago, decades ago, where basically if you were a casting director, you would send your sides, the script parts that you were casting for to Breakdown, and then Breakdown would send it off to the agents, and the agents would know, oh, I want to, you know, submit my actor for role X or role Y. But then Breakdown, being the only service that was doing that, they started to kind of play, you know, hardball with anybody that tried to get into the business to compete with them. And there was some lawsuits over that. And so I don't know that the industry wants to give them any additional weight, so to speak. But that said, there are ways around it.
Yeah. And it seems like a big pain. It's, you know, already, especially in TV, you know, commercials or movie or plays, there's a beginning, middle, and end to casting. Mind you, there's always recasting, especially on a long-running play, but it ends. On a TV series, it's an endless, you're on a train for 9 months. It never stops hurtling forward. There's always new episode with another, you know, dozen roles or 20 roles to cast, and you're going to see hundreds and hundreds of people. So that's just a nightmarish, you know, thing going on every week. So that is the hardest area to do it. But when you know about movies or ads or theater, especially plays, maybe this is a problem that can be tackled. It's a new task to do, and it's annoying if you haven't had to do it before. But, you know, it is, sounds like it's something whose time maybe has come.
Speaking of, well, in this case, people whose time maybe has come. Last week, of course, Aretha Franklin passed away. This week, she has some good news, and that is all of her albums, at least, you know, some of her albums, jumped into the top 10.
Well, no, not some, just one. Her 30 greatest hits set jumped into the top 10. It peaked at number 6. Last week it was at number 7 after just one day of people realizing Aretha Franklin had died. This week it moved up a notch to number 6. It's her highest chart entry in 50 years. Back in 1968, she had two albums in the top 5. She had Lady Soul, one of her greatest of all time. That was at number 2, and Aretha Now at number 3. So this is her highest charting album since her gospel album, Amazing Grace, back in 1972. And it's her highest charting album in 50 years, back to 1968, a few years before that. So that's awesome to see. So that's really cool. What I don't understand is how people glommed onto 30 greatest hits. When I went on Facebook and social media, I just said, the three Aretha Franklin albums I carry with me everywhere are I Never Loved a Man, Lady Soul, and 30 Greatest Hits, because that's by far the best greatest hits. But that was released in 1985, and it covers her peak years, you know, Think and Respect. But she's had lots of greatest hits compilations since then, albums with stuff like, you know, Who's Zoomin' Who and Freeway of Love and I Knew You Were Waiting for Me, her duet with George Michael. So she's had hits since then. But when you go to Spotify and scroll down, you're going to find like 10 or 12 greatest hit sets before you get to 30 greatest hits near the bottom. So I'm thrilled that people focused on the one that is the best greatest hit set and focused on the one that has the best quality material from her best peak years. Because if you weren't paying attention, you might have clicked on one that has some of her early Columbia singles or is a random collection of tracks that is not really representative of her best or just her later stuff or just a mishmash of stuff. 30 Greatest Hits is a really good album you can listen to from start to finish, but I have no idea how people realized that was the one to check out. So I'm delighted, but I'm puzzled.
I just don't understand how she died without a will.
Well, you know, doesn't like putting down things on paper. Aretha Franklin, famously, she had a purse at every concert. And she showed up, and you paid her in cash, and she put it in her purse, and she kept it with her. She did not want to be paid by check. She did not want to be paid any other way. She wasn't going to be paid after the show. I'm here. Where's the money? And then I will sing. Because she didn't trust the man. She never wanted to write a contract. She never wanted to sign anything. She hated, she did oral contracts for most of her career. She didn't trust things on paper. She didn't trust the man, probably for good reason. And she liked to be paid in cash. That's one reason why that documentary film about Amazing Grace, that Sidney Pollack concert film, hasn't been released. She said, I want $1 million in cash. And they're like, it's a documentary. It's not going to make that much money. And she, you know, it just didn't happen. She didn't want to sign a contract, didn't want to sign a release form saying they had the rights to show it, and thus film festivals wouldn't screen it. So I think that will happen and change now that she's gone, and her estate will say, yes, we want people to see her at one of her peak performances, and they will allow that to be happen, not just for the money-grubbing reason of there's money to be made, because it's a documentary film, but just because it's a great document, it deserves to be seen, and I'm excited to see it. But yeah, no will, no contracts. You want her to sing, you better have the money.
Well, so, when it comes to money and having a lot of it, there was one person who documented the lifestyles of the rich and famous, and that was Robin Leach, who was the host of Lifestyles and the Rich and Famous, and he died at the age of 76. The show ran for 11 years.
Journalist turned shill, but yes. God bless him. He's where you go, man, I could have made a lot of money. You know, he was a page one guy in the UK. But yes, you know, champagne wishes and caviar dreams, you know, is famous for his catchphrase and famous for that show that ran for quite a few years, and you know, more power to him, you know, harmless.
I actually met him a couple of times on press tours and stuff like that, not for his show, but like he would be like in a film or something, just as usually as himself.
Yeah.
Or the voice of something in an animated film, and talking with him was just so weird. You couldn't talk to him without hearing that distinctive accent, and you just like everything he said, you just were like, are you giving me a tour of somebody's house here? Like, it's just,
Well, he turned himself into a celebrity, but a trailblazer in a different way is John Carter. Not John Carter of Mars, which is what I think of every time I hear the name John Carter. That's the Edgar Rice Burroughs character. But this is John Carter, a pioneering African-American film editor. He died at 95 years old. God bless him. That's a rich, full life. He did films like Friday and Barbershop and Lean on Me, the stuff, more recent films that we remember. He also did the Elaine May film, The Heartbreak Kid, with a screenplay by Neil Simon. And he also edited the Oscar-nominated documentary about Dr. King called King, a filmed record summary to madness. And he really broke barriers, as you can imagine. He was the first African-American in network TV. He was hired by CBS in 1956, and he was the first African-American to join the American Cinema Editors Society. That's the ACE Society. So a great, satisfying career, right? Frankly, towards the end. I mean, Friday and Barbershop are pretty recent hits.
Well, an unexpected death was that of producer Craig Zaden, who, along with Neil Marin, produced, the Oscars a couple times recently.
Yeah.
The Oscar-winning film Chicago and the film version of Hairspray. And they did How to Succeed on Broadway with Daniel Radcliffe.
And your favorite TV's Smash on NBC.
Yes. I was really surprised to hear this. He died of complications from shoulder surgery. Surprising.
Yeah, every surgery is dangerous. You don't expect to die from shoulder surgery. Boy, that's hard to say. Shoulder surgery. But yeah, you don't expect to die from that ever. And of course, anytime you're cut open, it's not a guarantee that everything's going to be okay. So tragic and unexpected. Great career. He's nominated for Emmys for their TV special, Jesus Christ Superstar Live in Concert. A sad day. Very prolific stage, TV, and film producer. And here's somebody who I almost didn't include until I realized how cool she was. It's actress Barbara Harris. She had some cool roles. She was nominated for an Oscar, won a Tony Award. I certainly was sort of familiar, but I thought, do we have anything interesting to say about her? But I didn't realize she was a co-founder of Second City.
Yeah,
she won a Tony for The Apple Tree. She was nominated for an Oscar for the film Who is Harry Kellerman? You see, we're getting close to the end. I'm getting excited. I'm talking faster and faster. Roger Ebert singled out her performance in the film Nashville, where she sang the song It Don't Worry to Me at the finale as one of cinema's great moments. But her enduring legacy is with improv. She was involved in reportedly the very first improv group in the United States. That broke down and dissolved really quickly. And then she was a co-founder of Second City. Indeed, the very first number in the very first Second City improv show was Barbara Harris standing alone in the spotlight singing Everybody's in the Know. And she kept up that right up to the end when she was in hospice during her final days dying from lung cancer. She turned to the nurse and said, so what am I supposed to do? Lay here until I die? Sounds like something my dad would have said. So that's kind of awesome.
Oh, my goodness. Well, lastly, there is Neil Simon, the playwright, who died at the age of 91. I mean, he is a legend. Let's face it. Everything from, Biloxi Blues to The Odd Couple to Barefoot in the Park. I could go on and on and on.
Yeah, you could. I mean, he was a major force on Broadway. He had four shows on Broadway in the year I was born, 1966. Four shows on Broadway. That's kind of amazing. Andrew Lloyd Webber has done it. I think maybe Rodgers and Hammerstein. And tremendously rare for anybody, much less a playwright. He began in TV with sketch comedy. He was one of that fabled crew of us of writers on your show of shows, the Sid Caesar Show. Then became a huge monster on Broadway. Never got great reviews until really his autobiographical trilogy of plays, starting with Brighton Beach Memoirs. That's when he really got some respect from critics. And he even won the Pulitzer Prize for Lost in Yonkers, which is I think it's the first show I saw on Broadway when I moved to New York in 1991. That starred Mercedes Rule and in a smaller supporting role, Kevin Spacey. So, huge success and lived long enough to see his career really eclipsed or seem fashioned and out of date. He never got the respect he wanted. He really felt it was just because popular. He never. The idea that maybe his shows were sort of formulaic and not that good. I don't mean to be too dismissive of Neil Simon. I think shows like The Odd Couple and some of those shows really tightly written and are really fun and can be entertainingly done. And I do think his memoirs are really well worth reading. Some of his autobiographical plays are solid. He helped make Matthew Broderick a star. Matthew Broderick says, my career is, you know, due to Neil Simon. And the New York Times, I think, put it best as far as him outliving the era in which he lived in. The New York Times says he ruled Broadway when Broadway was worth ruling.
Ooh, now it's Disney ruling Broadway.
That's right.
But that wraps up our show for this week. And remember, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. It helps others find the show. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, along with links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, along with ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. We have a website, showbizsandbox.com. MGMT has a website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's moviepassanonymous.com.
Okay. If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. And don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what books you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
You know, MoviePass Anonymous, like AA.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a support group for people who need to get over their grief over the passing of MoviePass.
Right. But that, what the acronym would be MA.
MA! I lost my MoviePass! And scene.
What are you, like Barbara Harris?